Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Thursday, September 3rd, 2015. African Union leaders meet with President Kiir on implementing the peace plan.
Former Malian President, His Excellency Alpha Conaré, is the leader of the IGAD Plus, and he has been mandated by the African Union that he heads a special high political committee of the African Union for a follow-up of the IGAD peace process on South Sudan.
And the governor of Eastern Equatoria State makes an appeal for peace.
The people of Eastern Equatoria welcome the peace sign agreement, and that we are ready to implement it, and that we should start to begin a healing process and reconciliation among ourselves.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Malia's former president, who is also IGAD's special envoy to South Sudan, is meeting with President Salva Kiir to discuss the implementation of the IGAD Plus peace agreement. Alpha Omar Conaré arrived in Juba today and has been in a closed-door meeting with President Kiir. South Sudan's foreign minister, Barnaba Marial, says Conaré's visit proves that the region has not abandoned South Sudan.
Former Malian president, His Excellency Alpha Conaré, is the leader of the IGAD Plus, and he has been mandated by the African Union that he heads a special high political committee of the African Union for a follow-up of the IGAD peace process on South Sudan. Definitely, as you know, recently our president was able to sign the compromise peace agreement, and you know, within 3 days, said in the agreement, our president was able to issue a permanent ceasefire according to the peace agreement that is required by the implementation of the agreement. That is 72 hours soon after the signing that there should be a permanent ceasefire, which our president did actually on time.
How is this agreement going to be implemented when your side is having reservations?
You know the manner in which this process was rushed by the mediators and especially by the Troika and our other international partners. They never paid close attention that the peace process needs to be negotiated fully so that you get a win-win situation on the agreement so that the implementation will come easy. I think it is good for the world and IGAD to know these reservations so that when implementation comes, then everybody should pay more attention in how this could be implemented with more understanding of them. I think it is healthy that it goes that way.
And the IGAD Plus members are saying the same things that you are raising concerns about are the things that your delegation has been discussing with the rebels for 20 months. So there's nothing new.
Not
they are saying there's nothing new.
That is not true, John, to tell you the truth. In fact, some of them were being discussed but not concluded. What is the fact if you discuss issues that you have not concluded, that both sides have not concluded? And even the things we have actually discussed and agreed upon and concluded were not even included in the peace agreement, like during the Baradar discussions. We had a lot of areas we agreed, but the mediators just went and drafted a thing of their own and then used all the international partners and everybody else to put pressure and put deadlines for signing. They were only discussed, but not concluded. So why would you say that these were discussed over 20 months? There is no peace agreement without reservation in the whole world. Even the Iranian-American peace negotiation, they had reservations. Are we from heaven that we may not have reservations in our peace agreement?
It looks like the government is not happy with this agreement. Am I right?
We are not happy. Definitely, we are not happy with it. But we have signed it with the hope. That's why we brought forward the reservation, so that the implementation becomes more understandable to all the parties. So that when we come to an issue where there is a reservation, we will pay more attention to it, to how to resolve what caused the reservation. I think it is healthy for a government that wants real, genuine peace, a sustainable peace. That is a win-win for all the people of South Sudan. That's what the government wants. Don't forget, this is an elected president by 93% of its citizens, and he's dealing with a rebel leader that cannot challenge his presidential leadership in the country.
But the same people who elected him, 93%, are the same people who have been suffering for 18 months or 20 months. If the government wants to end the conflict, it should look at the people who are suffering as opposed to its own interests.
Yes, that's why we signed an agreement that has not been properly discussed, because we care about our people. They elected the president and that government, and therefore we care for these people. That's why we went out all the way to sign a half-baked peace agreement that needed more time to discuss issues. I think that the president cares for that. And that's why he's saying there are reservations. If we come to implementation, we need to pay more attention to these areas during the period of implementation so that everybody is aware.
What is the future of this agreement that you are calling half-baked?
This agreement, we are trying to get the best out of it by being implemented with understanding that there are reservation areas. And it is, by the way, it's a transitional one, a transitional government of national unity for 3 years, which will lead us to general elections, which must be free and fair, where the people of the Republic of South Sudan will choose who their leaders are. And I think that is the roadmap. And that's why we signed it, because it's not the final stopping point, but it is a road that will lead to general elections at the end of the 3 years, where our own people will be able to elect their leadership.
That's South Sudan's Foreign Minister, Barnaba Marial, speaking to me earlier today from Nairobi. Meanwhile, the governor of Eastern Equatorial State, Luis Lobong, is urging the people of his state to welcome back those who have taken up arms against the government. Lobong says the time has come for South Sudanese to rebuild their country, but he warns that some rebel forces in his state are refusing to abide by the ceasefire agreed to in the IGAD brokered peace plan. VOA fellow Justin Tito has this story from Washington.
Speaking at a news conference in the state capital Torit yesterday, Governor Lobong said, although the peace agreement was signed by both sides, some rebels are still mobilizing youth against the government.
We have seen some elements, supporters of the rebels, coming, mobilizing the youth to go and join the rebellion. And they have been planning to carry some assassination.
Sabina Dario is one of the national MPs representing the Chikdum area in the state. She says people in her area are ready to follow the peace plan's language regarding a transitional period for the government and the SPLM-in opposition. Sabina says she is not aware of any mobilization of youth to join the rebel groups.
I'm not able to make a comment because it is she who said there are some people doing unusual things, which means she knows what those unusual things are and where exactly did they happen, in which country. So far, I have no idea.
Oyet James, the leader of the youth in Eastern Equatoria's Magui County, says he agrees with Sabina. Last month, SPLA spokesperson Colonel Philip Aguera accused the rebels led by Riek Machar of attacking government forces in Eastern Equatoria's Pagari area. The accusations came hours after Machar and Pagana Mum signed the peace deal in Addis Ababa. About a week later, President Kiir signed the agreement in Juba. Oyet Nathaniel, who identified himself as a SPLM in opposition general, claimed responsibility for the attack. Lobong says the rebels should put down their arms for the sake of peace. He says the time has come to embrace peace because South Sudanese are all one people.
That the people of Eastern Equatoria welcome the peace sign agreement, and that we are ready to implement it, and that we should start to begin a healing process and reconciliation among ourselves, and be ready to welcome our brothers and sisters who have either run away from Eastern Equatoria for one reason or another.
In July, Eastern Equatoria state lawmakers serving in the national legislature signed a petition asking President Kiir to fire Lobong, stating that he was responsible for insecurity in the state. Lobong denies the accusation. No action was taken on the petition. For VOA News, I am Tito Justin in Washington.
From Torit, we move to Western Bahr al-Ghazal. Bahr al-Ghazal University administrators are recruiting professionals to address a staffing shortage at the institution. The institution has been struggling with for the past 4 years. When the university was transferred from Khartoum to Wau after South Sudan gained independence, most of the staffers are from northern Sudan, and they decided not to relocate to the new country. Michael Atit has more for VOA from Western Bahr al-Ghazal state capital, Wau.
Professor Samson Wasara, Bahr al-Ghazal University's vice-chancellor, says although gaining independence was a big victory for South Sudanese, it created a huge problem for Bahr al-Ghazal University. The vast majority of the professors were unwilling to move.
You know, the event of independence actually made our universities actually lose a greater number of lecturers and professors in the Sudan. And when we came back, there was a very acute shortage of staff members. And when I came here, I think we had only 125. That was actually last year.
This year, the staff has been increased to 190, but the administration says it should be about 250 to accommodate the 2,000 students enrolled at the school. To address the problem, Wasara says the university has developed a specific selection criteria for potential staffs which will fulfill South Sudan's educational policy standards.
We also made the restriction on age, because for teaching assistants especially, we set an age that we will not take somebody actually who was born in the 70s. So we need people and young fellows, both females and males, who were born actually in the 80s. Because by the time of advertisement, they will be in their 30s. And then if there is any training, then they will have the chance.
Wasara says out of more than 100 applicants, they were able to hire 58 qualified staff members. The university has 5 colleges: medicine, education, economy and social studies, public health and veterinary science. Wasara says if they can strengthen the teaching staff, they could compete on an international level. Beth Firmino, a fourth-year education student, says the recruitment would definitely boost their academic standards.
Things to do with recruiting lecturers or those teaching assistants, by the way, is fine and it's good, and it's just because by those years back, we were not having enough lecturers. But due to this current administration, is now making some of the things so interesting to the students and even to the entire university of Bahr al-Ghazal.
Wasara says his administration will send some of the newly recruited teaching staff for training and advanced studies in neighboring Sudan, Ethiopia, and Uganda. He believes that by this time next year, the newly hires will make a noticeable impact on the university.
When those people were sent for courses, this will again boost the university in terms of imparting knowledge, producing knowledge, and also sustaining programs, the academic programs.
The University of Bahr al-Ghazal is one of 5 South Sudan public universities established in 1993. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Wau.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. A South Sudanese beauty contestant in the United States says she will continue to work with orphans whether or not she wins beauty contests. That story when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
are you goal-oriented? Or do you wait to see what happens?
I am goal-oriented, but then I am more of a procrastinator. So I normally wait until the last moment, then I bring out the best in me.
Yes, I'm goal-oriented because I'm always having a vision and I'm always following my dreams.
I don't wait for something to happen. I actually struggle for something. I struggle to see that I fulfill what I'm looking for.
I'm goal-oriented. I don't just wait for things to happen.
Since I'm a believer, I think things come in their own way. Yeah, you can have a target, maybe you don't achieve it, and you may not have a target and things come up.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. Children in rural Cameroon generally receive poor education, but the government has introduced learning by computer, hoping that it can help fill the gap. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
9-year-old Charles Ngam Eboa lives in Bari, a small village in southwestern Cameroon. He speaks French and English, despite never having attended school. When Charles was 2, his father returned home from Yaoundé, where he had been educated. He introduced his son to the computer.
I started talking when I was 1.5. Then at 2 years old, they started taking me to read letters and count numbers. I learned human biology, botany, and zoology. Physics, I'll learn it when I'm bigger.
Charles now helps other children in the village. He and his father have 2 laptops, 3 tablets, and a generator to keep the devices powered up. They download free educational applications from the internet and use search engines to find new material. According to Cameroon's Institute of Statistics, 70% of children in rural areas do not go to school because of poverty or because schools are too far away or are not adequately staffed. Illiteracy rates in rural areas are high. Charles's father, Ebuangoti, says electronic learning or e-learning could be a solution. He says his son is an example.
He's a pure e-learner. He's never attended any traditional school, never. He learns essentially at home, and when he goes to school, he assists with tutorials essentially. For example, we can teach him mathematics, and after we give him tutorials to explain to other students who are much more older than him.
The government of Cameroon is fully behind the idea. Workers recently began constructing the first of a projected 200 computer centers around the country. The centers, with about 20 computers each, are designed to promote e-learning in rural areas. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Children's lack of education in several African countries is directly attributed to violence and political unrest. About 13 million children across the Middle East and North Africa are not able to attend school due to ongoing violence and political instability. For example, UNICEF, the UN Children's Fund, estimates nearly 9,000 schools in Libya, Syria, Iraq, and Yemen are no longer in use. VOA's Joe DiCapua has this report.
A new UNICEF report focuses on the impact of violence on students and education systems in 8 countries and Palestine. In Amman, Jordan, Dr. Peter Salama is the UN agency's regional director for the Middle East and North Africa.
We often really get focused on the political and military developments in the Middle East and North Africa at the moment. And what this report is really telling us is the massive human cost, particularly for children, of the crises and conflicts in this region.
The report is called Education Under Fire.
13 million children in these conflict-affected countries are unable to go to school, which represents around a full 40% of the school-age population in those countries. So it's a tragedy on a grand scale, and it's a tragedy, the story of which is not often told.
Salama says there's a disturbing trend that warring parties are deliberately targeting schools in the MENA region. Asked why they would do this, he says,
many, many of the armed groups say that the opposition parties are using schools for military purposes or as bases or as detention centers. I think there are rare instances of that actually happening, but I believe they're exceptions rather than the rule. Sometimes, unfortunately, military groups in this region use the bombarding of civilian infrastructure as a form of collective punishment against the opposing forces and the population that they think is supporting them.
Schools also become collateral damage in conflicts. And then there's the fear factor.
Certainly families have begun to fear sending their children to school, either because kids have died while they're in the classroom or because of the risks to those children physically on the way to and from school.
In the midst of conflict, kids are forced to grow up fast.
Many of the refugee Syrian children in surrounding countries such as Lebanon, Turkey, and Jordan are actually now the primary breadwinners in their family. They're the ones making a living for their families, and so they no longer have time to go to school. As well as that, we know that there's been major efforts by military organizations to recruit children into the armed factions, and more children at a younger age are being abducted and recruited.
And Salama says don't forget about what's happening in Sudan.
What we don't hear much about is some of these more silent emergencies, as we call them. And in Sudan, there's a full 3 million children who aren't able to go to school because of the various internal conflicts in Sudan.
This includes fighting between Sudanese government forces and rebels in at least three regions, including Darfur. The UNICEF regional director says the Middle East and North Africa are on the verge of having a generation of uneducated children. He says the world will pay a price if the problem is ignored. But he says there's still time to do something about it.
I think we need to put a lot of pressure on all the parties to the conflict to stop targeting schools, to do much more to protect schools. Secondly, we need to create both informal and formal opportunities to get as many as these 13 million children back into school as we can or into other educational opportunities. We need to create pathways between the informal education that's going on already to a more certified formal education, helping, for example, children do their exams.
Salama says some Syrian children have had to cross the front lines of fighting to get to places where exams were being given. One Syrian girl says she had to travel 14 hours to take her exams. Finally, the UNICEF official says a lot more funding is needed. UNICEF is appealing for $300 million this year to scale up education efforts. The Education Under Fire report quotes a teacher in northern Yemen as saying, "I have seen children trying to write on the ground because they want to learn so much." Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
26 young women competed for Miss Africa USA title this past weekend. Yega Majus represented South Sudan in the competition, which was held in Silver Spring, Maryland, just outside Washington, D.C. Majus finished in the top 10. She says there is much more than good looks. As my colleague Ayen Bior reports, Majus also has a kind heart and wants to do good things for South Sudan.
At 5 feet 9 inches, Maju towered over many at the Miss Africa USA pageant. The 25-year-old, who lives in San Diego in Southern California, says she took part in the Miss Africa USA contest to make her family in Central Equatoria proud and to let people see that South Sudanese women are not only beautiful, but also talented, intelligent, and hardworking.
I believe that being beautiful is not enough, that we also have to have education, just pursue our dreams, and we need to become more than just our beauty. Because in this world, in order for you to survive, you have to have brains.
Maju says she wants to use her talents to help people back home in South Sudan. She says she especially wants to help orphans and people who are suffering from hunger. The UN has said nearly 5 million people in South Sudan are severely food insecure because of the 20-month conflict that formally ended last week when President Salva Kiir signed a peace deal for the country.
So back home, people are actually just dying of the basic essentials that we here in the United States take for granted. So it's kind of hurtful sometimes to watch most of these clips or news articles. And our governments are not doing much to help the situation, to be honest. I wish they would come together and work together and realize the citizens should be put first, not political issues.
Maju says she was inspired to raise money for orphans during a church trip to an orphanage in Tijuana, Mexico, which is a 20-minute drive from where she lives. There, she saw hungry children who were traumatized by the loss of their parents. She immediately felt compelled to help.
That's where my eyes opened up and I realized that I needed to do more for my community and not just be all about myself. And that's when I learned to, that's where my platform came from. I wanted to help mothers and children who needed help.
Maju says one of the lessons she's taken away from the beauty pageant is,
don't just be beautiful, but be also have brains for it. And try to be greater than me because there's going to be better opportunities for them in the future than what I have now.
Now that Miss Africa USA is behind her, Maju is focusing on the brain side of her life. She is applying for scholarships that will allow her to finish her bachelor's degree and eventually go to law school and work as a lawyer one day. And as she makes her way through school, she fully intends to continue working to improve the lives of those who are less fortunate than she is. For VOA News, I'm Ayan Bior in Washington.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Here is a recap of today's news with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Damme.
Thanks, John. Mali's former president, who is also IGAD special envoy to South Sudan, is meeting with President Salva Kiir to talk about the implementation of the IGAD Plus peace agreement. Alpha Omar Konari says he arrived in Juba today and is spending a closed-door meeting with President Kiir almost all day. South Sudan's foreign minister, Barnaba Mariel, says Konari's visit proves that the region has not abandoned South Sudan. Louis Lebong, the governor of Eastern Equatoria State, is urging the people of his state to welcome back people who have fought against the government. Lebong says South Sudanese must rebuild their country together. He warns that some rebel forces in Eastern Equatoria are refusing to abide by the ceasefire spelled out in the peace plan. Speaking at a news conference in the state capital of Torit yesterday, Governor Lebong said although the peace deal was signed by both sides, some rebels are still trying to mobilize youth against the government. Sabina Darian, a national MP representing the Chukudum area in the state, says people in her area are prepared to abide by the peace plan, including its language on a transitional period for the government and the SPLM in opposition. Sabina says she is not aware of any mobilization of youth to join rebel groups since the peace plan was signed by both sides. And finally, administrators at South Sudan's Bahar al-Ghazal University are actively recruiting to address the school's staffing shortage, which has continued ever since the institution was relocated from Khartoum to Wau 4 years ago. Most of the staffers from the north had refused to relocate to the new country. Professor Samson Wasara, the university's vice chancellor, says although gaining independence was a major victory for the South Sudanese people, it's created a big problem for the university, since most of its professors and lecturers did not move to South Sudan. This year, the staff has been increased to 190, but the administration says it still needs about 60 additional personnel to accommodate the 2,000 students enrolled at the school. Wasara says the university has developed specific selection criteria for potential staffers to meet South Sudan's education policy standards. And that's a look at some of today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Damme.
Thanks, Carol. And that brings us to the end of our show for this Thursday. We now leave you with the song Abie by Abie Jasban. Abie, 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 Abie. Abie, 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 been listening to Abie Jasban with that song about the contested Abie region. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.